Thank you, Mary. I wish to, as I begin, convey my gratitude to the Theosophical Society in America for inviting me to this 97th convention and to enable me to share some thoughts with you this evening. In one of the recent issues of The Theosophist, there was printed a satirical poem on a Theosophist, having been extracted from an old issue of the London Punch. The title of that poem was, "My Love is a Theosophist." Some of you might have had occasion to read that poem, but I thought it would be worthwhile to quote a few lines therefrom. It said, "My love is a Theosophist. Her lunch is a pot of tea. Her breakfast a banana. For she says that matter tends to clog the spirit force behind it. My love is a Theosophist, or rather is no longer. For though her ego urge was strong, the cosmic will was stronger. While moving on the higher plane, she moved into a lorry. My love was a Theosophist, and really, I am not sorry." Now, as I put the question to myself, am I a Theosophist? I am not, nor I believe you like to be a Theosophist of this sort. Let us then explore, what is it to be a Theosophist? And as I develop my thoughts, presenting them before you, I would like to add that these are just some views, a presentation, a point of view, not a rigid presentation, the only view or a rigid view. These are some thoughts for you to consider. I would say a Theosophist need not necessarily be a member of the Theosophical Society. While a member of the society may not always be a Theosophist. It's really not possible to spell out in detail what it means to be a Theosophist. One can only attempt to refer to a basic approach, a guiding principle, and then to some aspects of the application thereof to our everyday lives. A Theosophist, I would say, is one the core of whose being is Theosophy. And Theosophy is divine wisdom. And the core of that divine wisdom, to my way of understanding it, is oneness of all life. Seeing in the myriad forms of life, mineral, vegetable, animal and human, the expression of the same oneness. According to the Vedanta philosophy, God does not create the world, but becomes it. It's a self-projection of the Supreme. a sense of realization of oneness or unity or wholeness, whichever way you like to put it, does not, however, mean drab, dull uniformity. It does not also mean becoming unmindful of all the variegated forms of life in nature, the beauty thereof, including mankind. The sense of oneness connotes a twin movement from the circumference to the center and from the center to the circumference. It's a constant pulsation, inflow and outflow. It's seeing the all in one and one in all, so that each form and each expression of life becomes a reflection of the divine glory, and therefore an expression of pure beauty and universal love. In that view, paganism and pantheism also fit in well as visions of the one in many forms and at varying levels of growth and development. In a beautiful book called Vivek Chudamani, translated as The Crest Jewel of Wisdom, Shankaracharya puts it thus: just as a pot made from clay is to be considered as clay, so what is evolved out of the Atman is always Atman. And everything is Atman, and there is nothing except and apart from it. Therefore, thou art that absolute peace without stain, great Brahma without a second. Growing awareness of this oneness or wholeness leads to welling up from within us of the quality of compassion, encompassing love for all mankind, all life. The quality so powerfully and tenderly displayed in the lives of great men of all religion, Buddha, the Christ, to name only the leading ones. How can one be happy when the neighbor groans in agony? How can one be complacent if the world continues to suffer? Compassion, according to Buddha, is no attribute, but the law of laws, the natural flow from the oneness of life eternal. A theosophist thus has to be a world citizen. His heart should beat in unison with the great heart of humanity. While a theosophist tries to be full of compassion and love for others, he is also discriminative and uses his head as much as his heart. He tries to be practical and wise in his judgments. Practical not from a worldly or narrow selfish point of view, but from the viewpoint of the larger good, the long-term good of all, including himself, since he is part of that all. He loves all, but in the process does not fail to correct those who tend to go wrong if he is responsible for them. Compassion, to my mind, does not mean overlooking or glossing over deliberate wrongdoing. But there is no anger or sense of condemnation therein. A judge awards a sentence of imprisonment to a man who has committed a crime, robbery or physical violence or whatever else it may be. But he does it as his duty to the society and also to the wrongdoer, for that is how the latter learns. A doctor cuts out a diseased part of a patient's body, causing him pain in the process, but the object is purely compassionate, the long-term health of the patient. The same sense of discrimination a theosophist tries to use in his work for helping others. While work to relieve physical suffering is good and very useful, it has its limitations. Work at the level of thoughts and words is perhaps more useful, lasts longer, and suffers not from limitations of physical means and resources. Light cast on the mystery and purpose of life, on the causes of suffering and the remedy thereof, on the attitudes of heart and head, which help to bring peace and hope and faith in the future, bring often far greater comfort. According to the Proverbs in the Bible, the lips of the righteous feed many. Thoughts are things, and a lot of very useful work for helping individuals and good causes can be done and is being done on the plane of thought. By sending out thoughts of love and peace to those who are suffering, thoughts of strength to those who live in fear and anxiety, thoughts of good cheer to those who are depressed, a considerable amount of work can be done. Collective thought also helps larger causes, such as those of preservation of peace, checking and neutralizing thought currents of hatred, intolerance and violence. Even in very small ways, one can help every moment of one's life. Instances are consciously putting in thoughts of comfort when writing a letter to a friend or relative who needs comfort, pouring out thoughts of love on one who is angry. Dr. Besant once wrote in the autograph book of a young theosophist, "Love those who are most unloving, for their need is the greatest." Even putting in thoughts of love, strength, and good cheer when shaking hands with a departing friend or relative has been known to work wonders. I would like to refer here to that quaint little advice contained in a passage in one of the New Thought books, quoted by Bishop Leadbitter in Masters in the Path. You must have read it, but it's worthwhile referring it to here. There it is said, "Knead love into the bread you bake. Wrap strength and courage in the parcel you tie for the woman with the weary face. Hand trust and candor with the coin you pay to the man with the suspicious eyes. The same discrimination a Theosophist uses in his studies. All knowledge is useful, and a Theosophist has to try to cultivate an eager intellect or a keen intellect. But there is no end to knowledge. More so in the present day world, where almost every day something new, something exciting, something fascinating, something fantastic even, is coming out in all spheres of knowledge, whether it be science or psychology, medicine or food. One can spend not one lifetime, but many, if one believes in more than one life, studying and never seeing the end of it. One has therefore to pick up the more important, the more useful, according, of course, to one's own temperament and one's understanding. Within the limitations of time and energy, one has to pick up the grain and leave the chaff. Not that the chaff is not relevant, it has its use, but perhaps not for the present and not at a particular stage of one's life. Sri Shankaracharya, again in the book I referred to earlier, The Crest Jewel of Wisdom, has put the whole problem of knowing in a beautiful way when he said, the real self is in essence the supreme Brahma, pure as space, void of differentiation, of boundary, of motion, of modification, of within and without, the secondless, having no other. Then he adds, so what else is there to know? When somebody asked a great sage how to reach self-realization, he said, where is the question of self-realization? You are that. Self-realization connotes duality. But there is no duality. You are the self. A man is known by the company he keeps. That was a saying that we learned as children. But I think more valid perhaps would be to say, a man is known by the life he leads. It's good to read books on religion, ethics and philosophy, and whatever else one likes to. It's good to be regular in going, for those who are interested in doing so, in going to the temple, the church, the mosque or the lodge. It's good to do one's daily meditation. It's good to hear discourses or participate in learned discussions on religion, ethics and metaphysics. But it seems to me it is much more important to live a good life. In fact, if we are seriously studying our books on religion or philosophy, if we are earnest about our visits to the temple, the church, the mosque or the lodge, and if we are devoted to our meditation, these should inevitably and imperceptibly affect our daily life and make it better and purer than before. Life is one and cannot be lived in compartments. One in home, another in meditation, and a third one in our office or factory. A wise one once said, highlighting this wholeness of righteous living, I care not what a husband's reputation or religion may be. If his children dread his homecoming and his wife swallows her heart every time she needs some help, he is a fraud, even if he prays all day long. If we carefully and consciously examine ourselves, we will find that we are most of the time thinking about ourselves, judging and reacting on the basis of how a thing or action or situation affects us, not how it affects others. My toothache, it was said long back, is more important to me than an earthquake in a distant land. My comfort, my needs, my feelings, my views should get precedence and priority. If they do not, we tend to feel hurt, unhappy, even sometimes angry. The same thing happens often even in the sphere of charitable and philanthropic work that we may choose to undertake. The work must be carried out the way we think best. We should always be consulted and our advice accepted invariably. If this is not done, we start sulking, feeling resentful, and often even drop out of that activity. A theosophist tries to watch and observe these attempts of his feelings and thoughts to mislead and beguile him. Every criticism he welcomes, because it helps to see himself as others see him, and thus enables him to chip off some of the angularities of his nature. He tries to dethrone himself from the pedestal he had consciously or unconsciously occupied at the center of his circle, and enthrones there the thought of the good of others, those he comes in contact with in his everyday life. Pride and egoism have no place in the life of a theosophist. In the Mahatma letters to A.P. Sinnett, it is said, "Friends, beware of pride and egoism, two of the worst snares for the feet of him who aspires to climb the high paths of knowledge and spirituality." A theosophist, while he tries to live by his ideals, is certainly not unmindful of his duties in the world, in his family and outside. In fact, he tries to do them better, with fuller attention and with a greater sense of dedication. In At the Feet of the Master, as you may be aware, a passage occurs which asks an aspirant to give all his attention to each piece as he does it, so that it may be his very best. And that reminds me of a piece finding place in a letter from one of the masters of the wisdom to an aspirant, where he says, "Does it seem to you a small thing that the past year has been spent by you only in your family duties? Believe me, my pupil, the man or woman who is placed by karma in the midst of small, plain duties and sacrifices and loving kindnesses, will, through these, faithfully fulfilled, rise to the larger measure of duty, sacrifice and charity to all humanity. And yet, while immersed in his duties in the world, whether they relate to the family, his office, or even his spheres of charity and service to mankind, a theosophist tries not to get attached to them. He works enthusiastically, but with a sense of detachment. This sense of detachment, even in the midst of apparent involvement in the world, has been described in different ways in the sacred books. In The Voice of the Silence, Madame Blavatsky says, "The branches of a tree are shaken by the wind. The trunk remains unmoved. Both action and inaction may find room in thee. Thy body agitated, thy mind tranquil, thy soul as limpid as a mountain lake." A theosophist is above all a gentleman or a gentlewoman. This connotes many things, not thus gentleness. Basically, the quality which indicates whether a person is gentle, a gentleman, is his constant thoughtfulness about others, not about himself. And it springs from the depth within, and is not just the superficial etiquette which is often worn by us merely as a mask on many occasions. A gentleman is one who is conscious all the time how each action or inaction of his affects others. He is forbearing and tolerant, knowing that no two persons look alike, think alike, or act alike. And therefore, in spite of differences in temperaments, even tempers, and differences in approach, he works with other like-minded persons in a spirit of cooperative endeavor. It's easy for any one of us to say, "I cannot pull on with Mr. or Miss X." That needs really no effort, does not display any quality of head or heart. What needs to be said is, "I will pull on with Mr. or Miss X in spite of differences." A theosophist is open-minded and therefore believes in freedom of thought as much for himself as for others. He receives and judges every new idea, every new presentation of truth without preconceived notions, without rigidity of approach. He welcomes all attempts towards unveiling the mysteries of life, whether they be by occultists or by scientists, and is happy to welcome light from whichever quarter it comes. He does not try to impose his views on others, but leaves them free to judge for themselves. He claims no superiority for his views or methods of work, but respects all those which represent unselfish endeavor and lead to the larger good. He is a learner, a keen student, a fearless investigator, and claims no infallibility for himself, nor does he take infallibility for granted in anybody else's approach and presentation, however high and mighty that person may be. He believes that freedom of thought is like a running stream of fresh, sweet water, fit to slake one's thirst, while dogmatism is like a stagnant pool, foul and unfit for life and growth. He also believes that truth can be found only by one's own effort. It cannot be handed over by anybody else to him on a silver platter, whether it be a god or a guru. It has been said that it is an eternal law that man cannot be redeemed by a power external to himself. He is the path, he is the way, and he is a lamp unto himself. Lord Buddha, in one of his sermons towards the end of his life, said, and I quote, "Even as gold is tested by fire and by rubbing, so must my words be tested by each for himself." A Theosophist believes that it is much better to be self-reliant and stumble on the way than to choose to be carried in somebody's lap like a small child. For he is certain that if he is earnest, unselfish, and pure in his endeavors, he will surely reach the goal. Intelligence is his lamp, unselfishness his watchword, and determination his strength as he treads the way of glory, not for himself alone, but for all. A Theosophist, as he tries to lead a pure life, gradually develops a sense of abiding serenity and joyousness. Not that he is unmoved by the suffering and sorrow that he sees around him, and which often comes to him also personally, but he knows that they are inevitable in a process of growth from ignorance to wisdom and self-knowledge. He is not indifferent nor unmoved by pain and sorrow, but views them in the perspective of the universal laws of life, which surely move towards the good, the pure, the beautiful, and the joyous. The heart of things is sweet. The essential or intrinsic nature of every living thing is joyous. Poet Tagore refers to this essential aspect of joy in our nature in a poem of his, and I quote a few lines. "When I bring to you colored toys, my child, I understand why there is such a play of colors on clouds, on water, and why flowers are painted in tints when I give colored toys to you, my child." Man's nature, the essential being, is also full of joy, but it often gets encrusted or covered by layers or veils of grosser matter. Our I-ness, our selfishness, born out of our mistaken identity with our vestures. The darkness the gloom, the shadow is in the veils, not in the self. And gradually, as by purity of life devoted to service of others, the veils over consciousness get thinner and joy and light start beaming out. Self-knowledge is a state of innate joyousness. And as Blavatsky put it, self-knowledge is of loving deeds the child. A theosophist cannot be selfish. Altruism is his watchword. He acquires knowledge because only a knowledgeable person can really help effectively. He treads the path of self-realization so that he may in turn become a more useful instrument for helping those who stand in darkness and ignorance. As he progresses on the path, a theosophist moves on from altruism, which is embedded in duality, on to sacrifice, self-abnegation. It's no more altruism, but the life divine, the integral living, which is living a truly religious life. As Plotinus put it, each being contains in itself the whole intelligible world. Even a faint glimpse of such a vision makes all the difference in one's approach to life and the world. And I quote from the Bible again, like as Christ was raised up from the dead by the glory of the Father, even so we also should walk in newness of life. Madame Blavatsky said in her first message to the American theosophists assembled in convention in 1888, men cannot all be occultists, but they can all be theosophists. Many who have never heard of society are theosophists without knowing it themselves. For the essence of theosophy is the perfect harmonizing of the divine with the human in man. A number of qualities and virtues have I listed as being relevant to being a theosophist. One feels it's a tall order. If one were to possess all of them, or even some of them, in perfection, one might be an adept or reach nirvana. But perfection is not expected of us. Only turning our eyes towards it and attempts to lead an unselfish life, a pure life, in our own humble, frail ways. As someone once put it, a theosophist is still a sinner. He only is trying to do better. It is a vision of glory that beckons him and inspires him. And it matters not to him how long and hazardous be the path and how imperfect and frail his body, his vestures to tread it. That vision of glory gives him strength, permeates his whole being, and instinctively finds a natural expression in his everyday living as well. Our growth or unfoldment must find expression in our lives, if it is real growth and is not just based on our imaginations and fantasies. May I now end with a few lines from a poem by Mr. Jinaraj Das, one of the former presidents of the society, which to my mind bring out a theosophist's way of everyday living in a simple but beautiful manner. And he said, "Word that is true and voice that is kind, thought that is just from a selfless mind, help that is swift and hurt that is spared, grief that is hid and joy that is shared. These be the flowers that I cull this day, smiling at eve in thy hands to lay." Thank you.